Hi, I'm Alex Bellinger, and this is Small Biz Pod on Friday, the 16th of October. Well, coming up in today's episode, I've got a fantastic interview with Roger Bootle, one of the UK's most renowned economists. And before you think, oh my God, an economist, he's actually really down to earth, a small business owner himself, and full of insight on the causes of the recession that we find ourselves in and the way out, with a lot of practical advice for small businesses on the near to medium term future and how they should be managing their way out of recession. So if you are looking to the future, looking to emerge from the recession stronger, this is definitely an interview that you should listen to. Other than that, I've got a great piece of music at the end of the show by a listener, Fitzpatrick Molden, who is a regular listener from the States. A lovely piece of progressive trance, I guess, or progressive house to finish. So stay tuned for that, all you electro or electronica fans. I've also got in this week's episode two copies of some really good CRM, customer relationship management software, to give away for you guys. So stay tuned to find out how you can get your hands on some CRM software from Sage worth 180 quid. And to two of you, it'll be free. So that's cool. Other than that, I'd just like to say a big thank you, as always, to Small Biz Pod's two current sponsors, XLN Telecom, who specialise in cost-effective phone lines, calls and broadband specifically for the small business market. Do check them out. Click on one of the banners on smallbizpod.co.uk. They've got some amazing offers there, and they're also super focused on customer service, unlike some telecoms providers I could mention. So do check them out. And also, of course, audible.co.uk, the world's largest provider of online audiobooks. You can pick one business audiobook or any audiobook you fancy from the 30,000 titles by heading to smallbizpod.co.uk, clicking on one of the Audible banners there, or by going to audible, audible.co.uk/smallbizpod. So do spread the word. If you know people who love audiobooks, or if you haven't tried it, now's an opportunity. You can sign up, and you don't have to stick with the free trial. It's a 14-day free trial, but you keep your free audiobook at the end if you want it, or, well, you can keep it anyway. So there you are. Okay, without further ado, let's go straight into that interview with Roger Bootle. Okay, well, in today's episode of Small Biz Pod, I'm very pleased to have on the show Roger Bootle, who is one of the UK's best-known economists, and he's the Managing Director of Capital Economics, an advisor to Deloitte, and also a specialist advisor to the House of Commons Treasury Committee. This is really on the occasion of the release of Roger's new and fascinating book called The Trouble with Markets, which deals with the recession that we're in, the causes of it, a look back at history, and possible ways forward. And now, whilst I know that many small businesses will be fed up to the back teeth of hearing about recession, this book does actually offer some really valuable and interesting insights about the origins of the problems that we're all facing and possible solutions too. And I think most small businesses are always interested in, you know, how they're just going to manage their business in the current and near and medium-term future economic climate. So, Roger, thanks very much for being with us today.
Pleasure.
First of all, what do you feel were the key root causes of what you've described as the Great Implosion?
Well, there were several causes rather than one, and I have a real go at the bankers, although I'm almost beginning to feel sorry for them because so many people are bashing the bankers up. You know, I think at one point it seems like they're going to be strung up and hung from Tower Bridge.
Yeah.
And I have a go at the regulators and the monetary policy makers, all the usual suspects. But then I suppose ultimately I come to pin the blame on two groups of people who I think most ordinary people, and including small business people, wouldn't have suspected were right at the root of all this. And that's first of all the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, that although there were big policy mistakes made by the central banks, they were done, they made those mistakes in the context of a world economy which was threatening to be quite depressed because of China's non-spending. Here they are amassing vast surpluses, piling them up, and other countries in Asia too. That's the first group of people. And the second, believe it or not, is my lot, the economists. And if I had to put my finger on, you know, if someone said to me with a gun to your head, right, bootle, enough of all this multi-cause nonsense, yeah, you know, come up with a single cause, I would say it was us, it was the economists, or some of them anyway, who believed this complete guff about the markets being always efficient and being best left alone. So this, I think, that explained not just why the banks got up to what they did, but the key thing is why the rest of us tolerated it. I mean, where was the criticism from the press, from the financial press in advance? There was none. And of course the regulators and the central banks, why were they so supine? We were saying, well, they were useless, but why were they useless? And I can provide an answer, and the reason is they didn't actually think that the job was necessary, because they thought actually the markets were fine left alone.
I know Alan Greenspan at the Federal Reserve formerly at the Federal Reserve in the US, has kind of accepted that he kind of didn't take into account human nature. And isn't, though, human nature an intrinsic part of all markets?
Well, I would have thought so. That's what I mean when I say that economists have got a lot of the blame to bear. The subject of economics, quite frankly, went stark raving bonkers in the last 30 years. It hasn't always been like this. I mean, you'd think, wouldn't you, that as a subject dealing with human affairs, you'd start off with human beings. That would be, I think, a pretty reasonable starting point. Well, it doesn't, really. It starts off with some completely artificial construct, which the textbooks often refer to as economic agents. Goodness knows whoever they are, but they're, you know, they're sort of fleshless, bloodless creatures who live forevermore and are perfectly rational, as opposed to the living creatures dominated by greed and panic that we've seen around us all too often over the last few years. No, the subject of economics has been complete twaddle for a long time. And the biggest casualty in all this is going to be, I think, that subject. It's going to have to be completely remade.
Yeah, which is clearly a huge challenge, particularly as it's been so embedded in the way that financial markets, in the way that governments, in the way that politics has reacted over the last two decades.
Yes, I think that this is actually going to be a major, major intellectual event. I mean, if non-intellectuals listening to this can imagine an intellectual event, but it's a contradiction in terms. What I mean is that, you know, the world of ideas, well, Keynes, of course, said this, it often seems remote from what practical people, including business people, are up to, but, you know, in the end, it's enormously important. And for the last 20 or 30 years, the dominating idea has been this idea of non-intervention, that the markets know best, keep governments out of everything.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't like that before. There had been an earlier cycle. I mean, when the Great Depression hit in the 1930s, at that point it was quite difficult to stand up and survive if you said things like, well, markets work perfectly okay, leave all alone. You'd liable to be stoned by a raging mob. And similarly, after the Second World War, because of all that, the prevailing wisdom, the conventional wisdom, as Galbraith called it, was that the state was needed, some form of state intervention was needed to support and constrain the economy. I think that was right. But then, of course, that went too far, and that was thrown out the window, and we got the Reaganite, if you like, Thatcherite or sub-Thatcherite view that everything is best left completely alone, which has led us to the position we're in now.
Yeah. No, but it's interesting. I mean, I talk to a lot of small businesses, and I'm a small business likewise, and when...
As am I, of course.
Well, yes, of course. And when the whole banking crisis erupted, and when the government started bailing out the banks on a massive, massive, unparalleled scale, a lot of small business owners thought, well, actually, we think the market is right. Our markets work in a way where if we screw up, we go bust. The banks shouldn't be bailed out. The banks should be left just to go bust.
Yep.
That's a horrific potential, you know, financial calamity, and one I think that you argue, you know, the leave things alone approach is something that you argue against quite rigorously in this book. But would it have been such a bad thing for the banks, for large banks, to have just gone bust? Mm. Wouldn't it have been an efficient way for the market to proceed, a kind of automated nationalisation through bankruptcy?
Well, I think that is a legitimate view, and I know quite a few people who do take that view. And it certainly has been a bizarre thing to see, with massive amounts of taxpayers' money poured into these institutions to keep them afloat, who'd earlier on been doing all sorts of reckless things and paying themselves ludicrous sums of money in the process. It was a bizarre setup, and quite clearly we can't risk a repeat of that again.
Yeah.
It all depends, I suppose, on the extent to which you think banks in particular and key bits of the financial system in general are special, and how damaging you think it would be if they went bust. Now, I think that the core of the financial system is, if you like, to use an analogy which I hope works, it's something like the electricity generating system.
Mm-hmm.
And if it goes down, then not quite all economic activity, but nearly all economic activity, grinds to a halt. Or let's move the analogy on a bit. What about a nuclear generating facility? What about that? What about the idea that we can say, let's leave this to the private sector, you know, if they can maximize their profits, we don't actually care about whether they maintain the thing, and if it goes bust and it sort of lies there and used properly, then that's all right too. I mean, not many people, I think, you know, would believe that, because
yeah,
they would think that the knock-on effects would be so devastating that a lot of innocent people would get caught up in the melee, and also that it wouldn't be reasonable to expect self-interested, profit-maximizing people running such a nuclear-generating facility to be able to operate fully in the public interest without some sort of public restraint. I think we more or less believe that. So we do have these things that are owned privately, don't we? But they're all in the context of some sort of public regulation.
Yeah.
Well, that's really, I think, the model I have in mind here. You know, we're all saying, let it all hang out, let them all go bust, and we'll be okay. Can you imagine what it would have been like if all of the leading British banks had gone bust, which I think was possible,
yeah,
with consequences for pension funds, insurance companies, small businesses indeed. What about this? You're a small business, you work pretty well, but like my business, Capital Economics, you know, we've done very well, we've built up some money. Unlike my worry, because we're a bit unusual, we don't borrow lots of money, we're cash rich. I actually thought about this. Here we are, we worked hard, we've been successful, we've got money in the bank. Banks go bust.
Yeah,
our money goes down the tubes.
Yeah,
you know. I mean, can you? I really think, actually, that a year ago we were on the brink of something that could have been worse than the Great Depression, because
yeah,
in this country, in the 30s, we didn't have bank runs or financial collapses at all. We had them in America, but not here, and not in much of the rest of the world. We could have had something where the whole financial system was effectively wiped out. That's a sort of laboratory experiment I don't want to live through.
No. I mean, I think probably most people rationally would agree with you. I think a lot of emotion and gut instinct and just bitterness about the way some in the banking system abused their position and got us into this state probably created a reaction that was irrational amongst some smaller businesses and individuals. One of the other interesting elements of your book, and which is to some extent to a layman is kind of counterintuitive, particularly when you're in recession, which many people have perceived as being a symptom of too easy credit, too much overspending, overinflation of assets that to an unjustified level. Your hypothesis, and you mentioned it earlier in relation to China, is that actually the problem is more to do with oversaving, super saving, and that saving is bad and spending is good. Now that's probably a massive oversimplification, but explain the saving problem.
Well, there's nothing wrong with saving as long as someone spends the money that you save. And for much of the time, of course, in an economic system, when it's normal and prosperous and successful, that's what happens. People put aside money, that's to say they don't spend it on consumption, they put aside money, and then somehow or other that money is intermediated and transmitted through the system to companies who borrow it, or in some sense make use of it for equity issues or whatever, to fund investment. That's fine. But what happens if people do a lot more saving and for whatever reason at the other end of the process, companies
Yep.
Don't do a lot more spending. Then what happens is the overall amount of spending goes down, and that's what causes recessions. Recessions are all about non-spending. People aren't spending enough, and therefore there isn't enough demand, and that creates unemployment, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And in particular, in the book, I wasn't saying that the problems are caused by too much saving in Britain or America or the West in general, but from the world's point of view, this was the problem.
Yeah.
And the super savers were located mainly in Asia, where China being the biggest offender by numbers, although there are some other examples of countries that are pretty spectacular. And actually, yeah, within Europe, there are some extraordinary examples. Germany's one, massive surplus it's running, and Norway and Switzerland similarly. Now, the point is, these countries, they're earning income in the world by selling their goods and services, that's fine. And of course, those things are being paid for by the rest of us. So they've then got the money to spend somewhere in the world on someone else's output.
Yeah.
If they don't do that, if they just sit there and say, okay, fine, thank you very much, we'll just let that pile up in the bank or in government bonds or whatever, which is effectively what they've been doing to a considerable extent, then there's a hole in demand for the world as a whole. What's happened is the Chinese or the others have sold something to us which we've paid for, and they haven't then spent the money, which means that we then have got a problem as to how we actually earn the money in the first place to pay for the goods they've sold us. And in fact, what happened is that the Chinese lent the money back to us with which to buy their goods.
Yes. So it was a kind of a one-way, two-way street.
Yes, very awkward. Now, faced with this situation, you see, I think for much of the last decade, the Western policymakers confronted a dilemma, essentially. I mean, if they could have accepted the situation that the Chinese just weren't going to spend their money, and not just the Chinese, the whole of East Asia, really, plus the oil producers, plus these Western countries, Germany, Switzerland, and Norway.
Yeah.
They could accept the situation, which would have meant, I think, a sort of crypto-recession probably running through the last 10 years or so, if they just accepted it.
Yeah.
Or they could have said to themselves, well, what we'll do is we'll offset the absence of demand in the world from these countries by creating extra demand domestically.
Yeah.
And that's what they decided to do. In order to keep the economies afloat, to keep unemployment down, to keep demand up, all the business flowing for the benefit of small businesses and everyone else, they decided, right, we're going to keep domestic demand up. And they're going to do that by essentially having very low interest rates and a policy of easy credit.
Yeah.
Now, at the time, they didn't think through, and remarkably, yet again, the economists didn't do a good job of helping them think through what the consequences of this might be. That's to say, I don't think there was anyone sitting there saying, okay, the problem with this is it's going to cause bubbles, and when they burst, we're going to be in deep trouble. I don't think they did. They just went ahead with it almost on autopilot.
Why?
Well, because unless you perceived the dangers of bubbles, and generally they didn't, it was the sensible thing to do. In that, you know, otherwise we'd have had a very long period of recession, unemployment, small businesses going bust, big businesses going bust, all the rest of it. So, you know, if you don't see the bubble danger there very clearly, then the sensible thing to do is to stoke up domestic demand in this way. Now, of course, after this episode, economic policy is another part of the whole world that's going to be radically different, because now I think they do understand about bubbles.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a remarkable thing to say this, but, you know, there has been a whole branch of economics, modern economics, which has denied the existence of bubbles. And for most people brought up in the subject who went on to become central bankers or policymakers in treasuries or commentators in newspapers or whatever, bubbles were sort of outre. I mean, they may have existed in the past, you know, sort of, you know, South Sea bubble and all that sort of stuff. But you can forget about that. As far as modern markets are concerned, it wouldn't work like that. So I don't think they properly understood that if you have this policy of very easy credit, you're going to end up with a disaster. Also, of course, they didn't understand how damaging the consequences would be if there was a bubble and it burst. I say they. I mean, there were some people early on who were very critical of this policy, people who thought that Greenspan in the States was making a huge mistake. There were some people. But overall, the strong consensus view was this was not going to be a problem.
Wasn't it more, I mean, wasn't it as well political expediency in that let's postpone pain for the, you know, the two election terms that we can, you know, reckon that we can win? I mean, the whole no more boom and bust mantra of New Labour over the last decade has kind of been proved to be ridiculous.
Well, I think that's true for the politicians, certainly, but it doesn't really answer the question with regard to the central banks or indeed the independent commentators outside. You know, that's why I think it was an intellectual failure on their part. As far as the politicians are concerned, I think you're right. It didn't make a lot of sense to be, or at least not short-term sense, to be questioning all this. I mean, it seemed to be Christmas and Easter rolled into one. You know, all this cheap goods pouring in from Asia and very low interest rates and surging house prices. Oh, it's wonderful. I mean, I've hesitated. I don't know the answer to this. At times, I did wonder whether the politicians were trying to fool us that they brought an end to boom and bust. Mm. But I think in the end, I've decided that actually they came to fool themselves. I think they probably actually believed it. Of course, it was in their interest to believe it, so it's sort of distinguish the propositions. But I suspect that's what happened. I mean, the longer it went on, the longer they sort of believe they brought and undertaken a massive transformation of the economy.
And it's that kind of crowd-induced psychosis which you kind of also refer to, in that, you know, you have economists saying the same thing, politicians saying the same thing, bankers basically believing that they can't fail.
Yeah. It's fascinating, isn't it? I mean, from today's perspective, it seems incredible that that was the situation. But I'm sure it comes through in the book that Keynes is one of my heroes.
Yeah.
Another one is John Kenneth Galbraith, who was a spectacularly wonderful writer and one of the older generation of economists who first of all looked at all the big questions, the interesting questions, and secondly could communicate to a broader audience rather than speaking in equations. Well, anyway, Galbraith was fascinating about the boom that led to the 1929 crash. He said, in thinking about that, you could be easily forgiven for imagining that what goes wrong is something in the minds of a few speculators who bid up the prices of assets. He said, you're completely wrong, because if that's all that went wrong, surely the boom stroke bubble would be burst earlier on and people wouldn't be taken in. No, he says, what happens in something like this is the whole of society is taken up by the illusion. They all become deluded. The governments, the central banks, the accountants, the overseers, everybody in the system is deluded. And that's what makes it so powerful and so dangerous. And I thought that was a wonderful insight of his. And that's surely what happened this time around. I mean, before the banking crisis really burst, just about everybody thought, you know, house prices could go on up and up and up forever and that the boom was genuine, and banks, no problem with them lending all this money and financial derivatives and ninja borrowers and all that. Virtually everybody, with very few exceptions, was signed up to all this. So I think you should best think of it as a sort of collective delusion.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose the issue then is, these booms and bubbles and busts seem to be inherent in the system. There have been enough of them historically, and they repeat. Maybe not on a cyclical basis, but certainly perhaps on a random basis. Mm. Another sort of a popular person writing on these types of subjects is Nassim Nicholas Taleb, who's the whole black swan phenomenon, which is kind of, you know, these events that just appear out of nowhere that are just so unusual, are completely unpredictable. You can really only expect them, but never know when they're going to happen precisely. Is there any way in which, a remodeled financial markets, a remodeled economy, a remodeled approach to this whole thing can ever smooth or eradicate those black swan moments?
Well, I don't think it can eradicate them. It's all a matter, really, of how prepared it is for them. Because we were operating a system which basically didn't believe that they were going to happen. I mean, when you actually look at the so-called risk management systems, I mean, it is utterly bizarre. I mean, I'm now, of course, extremely long in the tooth, so I'm someone who's lived through, you know, myself quite a few financial crises. And as I've got older, of course, I've encountered more and more people in senior positions who haven't.
Yeah.
And I've been astonished at their naivety and their lack of historical knowledge, both, as it were, academically and in terms of experience, and their preparedness to rely on the evidence of the recent past, which to my mind is just one sort of period in this whole wonderful quilt pattern of periods across history, one particular little period of comparative stability. And it was on the evidence of that they based their risk management models. I mean, absolutely extraordinary. Greenspan, again, the other day said something in that wonderful deadpan way of his. He says something like models of financial riskiness or whatever, which base themselves on periods that haven't experienced a sense of panic, will tend to underestimate the potential scope for price movements.
Yeah.
you can say that again.
Yeah.
My point is that, you know, given that we know that 1929 did happen, and there were massive crises in the 1970s, and there were several occasions since when the world came pretty close to disaster, and there was the South Sea bubble, and there were financial panics throughout the 19th century, it does strike me as rather odd to, you know, only look at the last sort of 10 or 15 years outturns when things were not that bad, and imagine that that describes the world.
Yeah.
So I think we've got to be prepared in the financial system for periodic disasters. I've got a section in the book where I talk about the way that the theorists who came up with all these risk models developed quite a lot of their thinking connected with the world of gambling.
Mm.
But the bit of gambling that they looked at, and this is really instructive actually, was roulette. That's to say, a game of pure chance where there was the possibility for, and certainly in contemplation, the possibility of, as it were, infinite playings.
Yeah.
And if you imagine a perfectly balanced roulette wheel, outcomes, all these outcomes about the number of twos and blacks and reds and so on and so forth, which is described by a normal probability distribution and all this caboodle.
Yeah.
And I'd say the trouble is, as far as financial events in particular are concerned, and I think life in general is concerned, the form of gambling they should have been thinking about was not the roulette wheel, but horse racing.
Mm.
And in particular, what they should have done is gone and watched the Grand National.
Yes.
You know, that this seems to me to be more a model of the way life works and the financial system works. You know, someone who is 20 lengths clear and he comes up to Beecher's Brook and plonk, he's down on the floor.
Yeah.
And suddenly 100-1 outsider romps home. You know, that's, I think, more a description of what life is actually like.
Yeah.
But they missed it. They were in trying to measure risk, they were looking at the wrong thing, in my view.
Yeah. Let's just come back to kind of a focus that is going to be very relevant to most small businesses right now. There are three issues. And the first thing, I suppose, to ask, and this is very much the how long is a piece of string question, is how long is this recession going to last? You know, there are signs already, you know, house prices purportedly are rising again. We didn't hit the end of a technical recession this quarter, as many had predicted, but you know, there's weak growth anticipated in the early part of 2010. You're cautioning against over-optimism at this stage, aren't you?
Yes, I am. I have to say, in answer to your question, when's it all going to end? No one knows, of course, least of all, most of all, indeed, myself. And anyone who pretends to know is either a knave or a fool. It's possible, it seems to me, that we're all going to be surprised by how quickly we come out of it, because after all, you know, most people were surprised by we got into it in the first place. So,
yeah.
You know, if I were thinking, well, I am thinking about it, I mean, I would give some weight to the idea that maybe we're going to come out of it whizzingly quick. However, I don't think myself that's likely, and I would advise all small business people to be assuming, be prepared for something better, but base your plans on something a good deal worse than that. Because the evidence of history is that when recessions occur because of financial collapse, the effects tend to be very long-lasting. I mean, we saw it in the 1930s, we saw it in Scandinavia in the 90s, and Japan in the 90s.
Yeah.
It's not a normal recession. I mean, what's happened is that the financial structures have been severely damaged, people's balance sheets are damaged, there's not a normal bounce-back mechanism in place. Moreover, there are quite a few risks, I think, still to come. There are risks on the international scene from protectionism, which I think is a big danger.
Yeah.
The banks are going to be weak for a considerable time. In this country, there's surely going to be a very severe fiscal tightening next year,
yes,
which is going to suck demand out of the economy. Now, a lot of business people listening to this may well think, well, as long as they, you know, just cut spending and cut out all those wasteful people in the public sector, that's all right. Well, I'm afraid it isn't, because those wasteful people in the public sector, they also spend money.
Yeah.
you know, a large amount, directly or indirectly, of the business that flows to business people comes from the public sector. Now, I mean, it might be the right thing to do, and I happen to think it is in the medium term to reduce the size of government spending. But be under no illusions, in terms of what that does to the flow of demand and the economy in the short term, it ain't going to be good.
Which brings me on to two further issues which are very apposite in terms of SMEs, and that is, one, availability of money, which the whole interbank lending issue and the amount of money that is not available to small businesses to borrow, to use as overdrafts, to help them grow and to help stimulate demand themselves. It feels like a catch-22 situation at the moment for many businesses, I think.
Yes. Well, just to sound a bit bullish for a moment, I mean, I suspect that the worst is over. You know, we had that period a year ago when the whole financial system looked as though it was going to be imploding and banks were in a serious bad way. And then it was very difficult to get, for almost anyone, frankly, to get finance.
Yeah.
I think we're past all that, and I don't think we'll get back to anything quite as bad as that. But banks, it seems to me, so many of them, are like purveyors of umbrellas. You know, when the sun's shining, you've got them all over the place, and when it's raining, you can't get hold of one.
Yeah.
And there they were as the boom was approaching its peak and asset values were soaring to ridiculous levels, and risk objectively interpreted was, I think, growing. And there they were prepared to pour out money like the clappers, maybe not to all small businesses, but in general they were. And then afterwards, when asset prices have fallen and the economy is weaker and so on and so forth, they then tighten up.
Yeah.
I have to say that if I were running a bank, I would now be starting to be rather more keen on lending than I was a couple of years ago, because the risks seem to me to be lower now.
Yeah.
Now things have fallen, but that's not the way they work.
No, they're catering to their shareholders, and therefore they're talking. They really aren't. They aren't. They aren't. They still in the mentality that created the problem, in that they're shoring up their own balance, balance sheets.
Well, that's some of it, but I think it's all to do really with the way they view risk. I mean, this is true not just of them, but of the financial sector more generally, and I think probably of most people.
Yeah.
It's into human nature, this. If you've experienced a long period of growth and success, you get more. Most people get more confident. That's to say, they look back rather than they look forward. So as the economy is going, you know, swimmingly along and asset prices are going up and up and up, they think, oh, this is all right.
Yeah.
So they think that there's not much risk. Now, someone like me, looking at these things with an eye on the past, actually, the longer this goes on, to my mind, the riskier it actually becomes.
Yeah.
So I would think they ought then to be tightening up. Then comes the crash, and they think, oh, God, this business is so risky. I shouldn't have done all that. You know, oh, it's terrible. So then they withdraw and become more risk-averse.
Yeah.
So I think this is really the main problem. They're now more risk-averse than they were, when you'd think that, objectively speaking, if anything, they probably ought to be less risk-averse.
Yes,
now.
Which just demonstrates the kind of complete lack of apparent the lack of understanding of risk, really.
Well, I think, you know what, I think it's probably just deep in human nature. This is quite natural.
Yeah.
Again, it's an example of what I said before about the whole system being taken in, including the banks. They thought that it would end to boom and bust as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, they didn't believe house prices could fall. They didn't believe that commercial property prices would fall the way they did. Some of us, dare I say it, were telling them.
Yes.
But they didn't believe it.
Now, finally, what, in your opinion, should small businesses like yours and mine and listeners, what approach should they be taking in terms of kind of planning the medium-term future for their businesses? That's a massive question, and obviously depends on what sectors you're in, etc., etc. But in terms of, you know, preparedness for an economic future in the medium term, what should we be thinking about?
Well, I can only offer a few generalities, and you
yeah.
might think there's a general that aren't worth very much. First of all, I'd say that I think, on balance, I'd be quite optimistic, actually, about the medium term. There's a great temptation, I think, after one of these disasters, and I say I've lived through quite a few myself, to think, well, that's it, you know, the end of the world is nigh, and so on, and batten down the hatches. I don't think that's right. People thought that when we came out of the ERM in 1992.
Yeah.
They thought it in 74-5, when the whole system was imploding, and doubtless there were other occasions. I thought it was 1929-31, of course. And after each of these, actually, after a period of a few years, there was a prosperous future ahead. I'm sure that's true now. I think the secret is not to go mad initially, because I do think the next couple of years are going to be difficult.
Yeah.
And of course, if you build for growth and you invest heavily and you expose yourself financially and so forth for the next couple of years, thinking that the boom's going to come, and then it doesn't, you have a hard time, then you're not going to be in a position to make the best of it when a few years afterwards the economy is very strong.
Yeah.
The general folk memory of the 1930s is it was a terrible time. Well, that's partly true. Certainly the early 1930s were difficult with unemployment high and so on and so forth. But that period saw Britain record its fastest rates of economic growth ever, far faster than during the Industrial Revolution. Actually, in terms of growth rates, the 1930s were a tremendous boom period for Britain. I don't know if to go quite that far, but I could see a period not that far ahead when we do very well. And in particular, Asia, which in my book I've talked about as a source of some of our recent difficulties, can also potentially be the source of great strength and prosperity. If there's going to be a solution, global solution to all this,
yeah,
it's going to involve China and these other countries changing course and spending a lot more money. I think that might well happen. And that we'll therefore see world markets dramatically stronger, and it's important, therefore, for British businesses to get a share of them. I know not every business can hope to get exports, but this is where the future lies for us. I mean, we've too long in this country, we've relied on consumption, credit, booming house prices, all this stuff, public sector.
Yeah.
Now the pendulum's swung, and with this very competitive exchange rate, if you're in the area where you can conceivably export, this is what you've got to be thinking about, it seems to me, and particularly exporting to Asia.
Roger Bootle, that's a good positive note to end on, and thanks very much for your time.
Pleasure.
So there we are, a great pleasure to have Roger on the show. I hope you found that interesting. His book, The Trouble with Markets, Saving Capitalism from Itself, was released yesterday and is available on amazon.co.uk. So check that out. Well worth reading, very, very thought-provoking. And accessible too. Okay, now if you would like a free copy of Sage's ACT CRM software worth £180, all you got to do is send me an email and tell me why you want it. And then probably in a couple of weeks I'll pick a couple of names out of the hat and send two of you a free copy. So that's cool if you're in the market for CRM software, a good way to start. Now, with that said, then let's move on to music. And as I said, it's music from Fitzpatrick Maldin, who's a US listener who does some really, really, really great house music, I would say, and particularly love his progressive stuff. And this is a track by Fitzpatrick, and it's called Will I Ever Love Again?